This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Epidemics don't announce themselves. They move in slowly, one case at a time. One person showing up at an emergency room with symptoms, an admitting nurse or doctor taking down the details. When did it start? Have you been traveling? What did you eat? Soon another case shows up, and another, and a pattern begins to emerge, and the doctors and nurses try to make sense of the pattern. Maybe it's as simple as the bad potato salad at picnic. Maybe it's as complicated as the very first U.S. case of West Nile virus, or SARS, or HIV. When the local health professionals are stumped, who you gonna call? The disease detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, a group of people trained to figure out the causes of an infectious epidemic. In this hour, we're going to get an inside look at the Epidemic Intelligence Service. How are they trained? What types of diseases do they work on? We'll also take a look at the state of preparedness here in the U.S. Are we ready for a bioterrorist attack? How about a flu epidemic? If you'd like to get in on the conversation, you're more than welcome. Give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my first guest. Myron McKenna is a science and medical writer at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Her new book is Beating Back the Devil, On the Front Lines with the Disease Detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, published by Free Press. She joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
And now, is it true that the Epidemic Intelligence Service was actually started because of the threat of bioterrorism?
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
I had never heard the story, and I'm sure many other people also have not heard it. The Epidemic Intelligence Service, the Rapid Reaction Disease Detective Force of the U.S. government, actually dates back to 1951. During the Korean War, there were fears that soldiers fighting in Korea would be exposed to biological weapons, not know it, and bring infections back to the United States and spark epidemics here. And so the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, decided that what they needed was a rapid reaction force like this to go out and check out every outbreak to see whether it was naturally occurring or intended, because they knew that both a naturally occurring outbreak and one that was deliberately caused would, to start with, look the same.
So they created like a disease SWAT team, something like that?
They did, sort of, yeah, although SWAT team implies that they're swooping around in Black Hawk helicopters with, you know, Tyvek suits on. And in fact, when they go out to outbreaks, most of the time all they have are gloves and masks and a laptop.
Huh. And it's come full circle. They were called to respond to the anthrax attacks, right?
I know. Isn't that interesting that for almost 50 years, the Epidemic Intelligence Service became a force that looked at, responded very quickly to naturally occurring outbreaks because, as we now know, no biological weapons were used in Korea. And then in its 50th year, in 2001, the EIS became the frontline responders in the anthrax attacks.
Yeah, because we've never heard much about, you know, there's been no TV series like CIS about them, you know, where they swoop down and investigate attacks. It's sort of
well,
been,
actually, there is one now.
Is there one now from the EIS?
Well, no, not quite.
Yeah.
There's a show on NBC this year called Medical Investigation, and it posits a rapid reaction elite force of disease detectives within the U.S. government. Unfortunately, it gets a number of minor details wrong. It says that they work for the National Institutes of Health. It gives them a Black Hawk helicopter to swoop around in, and they all have much better clothes and haircuts than I've ever seen at the CDC.
All right, let's talk about what the real-life team is like. Give us an idea of what, you know, a typical case. Pick a typical case and how they react to it.
Sure. Here's a perfect example. Now, first, just to sort of lay the groundwork, the members of the Epidemic Intelligence Service are young health professionals. They are either doctors who've just finished residency or PhDs who've just finished their training. And sometimes they can be nurses, veterinarians, dentists in the class that I followed that began in 2002, a lawyer for the first time. And in the fall of 2002, a young woman in Atlanta died in a car crash. And doctors fought to save her life and were unsuccessful, and her organs were donated, and they were given to four people, two in Georgia, two in Florida. Within a month, all four of those people fell desperately ill with encephalitis, and one of them died. Now, there was an obvious connection here. Four organs all came from the same person. And when they did analysis, the individual doctors did an analysis of the various tissues and fluids from these people, they found that they all had West Nile virus, which had come to the South in the fall of 2002. But none of these people had been outside. They'd all been sick in hospital for a very long time. So, as you said, who are you going to call? They called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, and a young infectious disease physician named Martha Iwamoto, assigned by the CDC for her EIS service to the Georgia Division of Public Health, actually puzzled out what had gone on, which was the West Nile virus had been passed from the young woman who had died to the recipients in her organs. Not only that, she had gotten it in a bag of blood that was given to her in the emergency room.
Hmm. That's amazing. So do they have to wait to be called in, or do they have their feelers out all the
That's
time?
That's a really good question. The answer to both is yes, actually. They do need to be called in. The initial arrangement under which the EIS was founded back in the 1950s was that the CDC would send help to any state health department that wanted it, whenever they wanted. They wouldn't pick and choose among outbreaks, but they had to be asked. And now that's true not just for states, but also for ministries of health in foreign country, because the CDC does a lot of international work as well. However, since you can only belong to the Epidemic Intelligence Service for 2 years and then you have to go and do something else, lots of people stay in public health. About two-fifths of the 2,700 alumni work at the CDC, another two-fifths in state and local health departments and academic public health, and they make an informal network that always has its feelers out and always feeds back to the CDC.
Are they now particularly, are their feelers out looking for a possible bioterror attack? Are they being trained for that?
Yeah, as described in the book, the first group to come to the CDC after the anthrax attacks, the class of 2002, because they're named for the year that they start, had the first actual bioterror response training ever given to Epidemic Intelligence Service members, even though, you know, for 50 years they had been theoretically a bioterror response force. And so now they've learned to respond to nuclear, chemical, and biological attacks, and they've been coached by their instructors to always keep the possibility of bioterrorism in the back of their minds.
So you think they're very well prepared, funded, prepared, ready to go?
That's a different question.
Oh, they're not, okay. Let me just take that as a question.
Not that they're badly funded and not that they're badly prepared, but, certainly, preparation in the United States and funding has ramped up enormously since the anthrax attacks. Mm-hmm. In the year before anthrax, the CDC got about $128 million to deal with the possibility of bioterrorism. The year after, it got $1.1 billion, a lot of which went out to the states, and it's stayed at that level ever since, including in the coming budget year. Mm-hmm. So certainly, they're better prepared, but are they perfectly prepared? Probably we'll only know when an outbreak starts.
Talking with Maren McKenna, who is author of Beating Back the Devil on the Front Lines with the Disease Detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service, our number 1-800-989-8255. Joining me now to talk more about how prepared or unprepared, as the case may be, we are for the possibility of a bioterror attack or a large-scale outbreak of an infectious disease is my next guest. Shelley Hearn is the executive director of the nonprofit group Trust for America's Health. She's also a visiting scholar at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, and she joins us from Washington. Thanks for talking with us, Dr. Hearn.
It's a pleasure.
Also, Arnold Manto, he is professor of epidemiology and the director of the Bioterrorism Preparative Initiative at the University of Michigan. He joins us from the campus in Ann Arbor. Thank you today, Dr. Manto.
Good afternoon.
Let me first ask Shelley Hearn, how prepared are we? You heard Maren McKenna talk about, how prepared are we?
It's a little scary, isn't it, out there? We are much better prepared, but let me tell you, we have a long ways to go, and that's part of the problem. We're actually starting to cut some of those budgets. We're starting to undermine some of the incredible advances we've made, and we need to be paying attention to how much more we need to better be prepared for the full spectrum of threats out there. It's not just smallpox. It's not just anthrax. It could be Mother Nature that throws us the next curveball.
You write in some of your writings that something interesting is that very little of the public funding, the bioterrorist federal funding, that aid, has actually made it to the places where it needs to go.
Well, important investments were made. Maren pointed out that about $1.1 billion a year now has been going out to states and to local agencies. But the reality is these agencies were very underprepared to begin with. There's a lot of basics to be fixed. Before 9/11, you even had local health departments that were using rotary phones They didn't have computers. They didn't have internet connections. There was a lot of fixing to be done. We've started to make that progress, but it's very far from where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Maren, you pointed out, you gave a dramatic example of how unprepared we were to meet the challenge of the bioterrorist attack. For example, the EIS responders for the anthrax attacks didn't even have a usable laptop with the right type of software to keep track of the data.
Yeah, when it became clear, this is actually a few weeks before anthrax, when they first responded to the World Trade Center attacks, which for the EIS sort of merged into the anthrax attacks because most of them never came home in between. The CDC knew that they needed to get people out very rapidly. And they also knew that they were going to New York City, where a lot of the cell phone towers were down, a lot of the phone lines were gone. They had no idea what they were going to see up there. And they were thinking at the time that the World Trade Center attack would be immediately followed by a bioterror attack. And so they lined everyone who was going to go to New York City on a borrowed plane up in a corridor at the CDC's main building, in an attempt to get all of them to be essentially on the same page with their technology. And every single one of those old laptops crashed or choked on the downloads. They didn't have two-way beepers. Most of them didn't have cell phones that would work. It was very troubling.
One would hope that's gotten a little better at this point.
Oh, I think a lot of them carry BlackBerries now.
Well, that's encouraging. but so the communications hasn't, gotten that much better. Shelley, what do you think?
Well, we've seen improvements. One of the great investments has been what's called the Health Alert Network. Before, when anthrax first hit in 2001, you had state health officers that were getting better information from CNN than they were from CDC. That's a problem. Today, that's significantly improved. We're almost, in a sense, hot-wired. We have CDC linked into all the states and then the locals, which is a huge improvement. But it also gets back, yes, they have the BlackBerries, but there's also a lot of basic equipment, a lot of basic training that's still missing in the gaps. And it gets down to public health has not been the same priority for first-line responders the way we've seen the investments in police and firefighters. And the reality is they're just as important. We need to have those troops out there, and we need to have better support for them.
Mm-hmm. And before we go to the break, Arnold Donald-Monto, how prepared are we for this flu season? I can tell you from, looks like there are almost going to be riots at some of these, I may be overstating it a bit, some of these centers looking for the vaccines.
Well, it just shows us that we're not prepared for unexpected happenings. And the unexpected happening here is that nearly half of the flu vaccine supply for the United States disappeared overnight. This means that we need to diversify in terms of our supply of vaccine, and we need to really have a long-term plan if we intend really to control flu. We also have to prepare, which we have begun to do, for the next pandemic, which is exactly what we heard before about Mother Nature throwing us a curve.
Mm-hmm. Can we dilute any of the flu vaccine as we did for the smallpox vaccine and maybe stretch it out?
Studies have been done actually by NIH at the last time we had flu vaccine delay to examine just this point. And it looks yes, we can dilute the vaccine. What we don't know is whether it's going to protect exactly to the same level. We know it produces almost as much antibody, but we would expect that since protection correlates pretty well with antibody production, that would be the case.
All right, we're going to have to take a short break and come back and talk lots more. Take your questions, talking about how prepared we are for any kind of outbreak of infectious disease. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break.